So hello, everyone. This is a rare pre-recorded Wholeness Hangout. My guest, Bill Cumming, is a man I became aware of over the last year or so, whose work called to me so deeply because Bill, for me, this is just Molly's story, but Bill represents a person who is living and embodying and engaging with spiritual principles in the world in a way that makes a difference. Bill lives and works in ways that make a contribution. It looks to me like he lives as though living could matter, as though our choices matter, and as though being responsible, taking responsibility, is an active possibility and an invitation for us. And a lot of these are, for me, somewhat loaded terms. They're terms that over the years I've had different relationships with. And I'm really looking forward to unpacking some of them with Bill today, because I've noticed in my own journey that there's a way in which what the sages point to of all being well, of love and peace, of underlying wholeness and well-being, can take me to a place of, okay, so everything's fine, so what is there for me to do? What matters? On what basis do I take action in the world? How do I make meaning? And it looks to me like Bill Cumming has, I don't know if he's got the answers or just lives the answers, but I like what I see and I wanted to have this conversation with him. So that's my story. And for the next hour, I'm going to stick to it. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Molly. That's very gracious. One of the things that I don't purport to have at all are the answers. I actually think that the answers in many cases may be multifaceted. What I came to know when I was 17 was, actually when I was 14, was that how we're being in the world did have a tremendous impact. And that really shaped a lot of the way I use what I've discovered since then. As you know, my work really changed dramatically 37 years ago when one of my children was raped. And I continue to want to fast forward so that people know that that young woman is now the chief communicator for the VFW for the state of Massachusetts and the state adjutant for the VFW for the state of Massachusetts. And Joy would hasten to have me add that that's not something that one gets over, but Joy made choices that allowed me to see that there were things that needed to be done in the world. That was the moment at which I realized nothing I had done up until that moment mattered at all if we lived in a world that was so full of violence and damage. So I started to be able to see it differently. But the thing I wanted to talk about for just a moment was what happened when I was 14, because it was then that I met my most powerful and original mentor, a man named Albert Boothby, which is why my organization is called the Boothby Institute. Albert was my high school history teacher, and I was thrilled to get out of my home. As a freshman in high school, I went to an independent school that was near where we lived. And unfortunately, in the summer of the year between my freshman and sophomore years, my dad lost his job, and my parents had no ability to pay for my continued education there, and consequently, it looked like I was going to have to be pulled out of that school. But the headmaster gave me an opportunity to stay there in that school on full scholarship, which was a great gift. But it also allowed me to continue my relationship with Albert Boothby. We won't have time to go into it, but my situation at home, I felt like I was being given reprieve from a war zone. My parents didn't get along at that period, and Both of them came to a place of being at real peace in their lives individually, not together, but individually. But I was thrilled to get out of there. But I also was pretty distant and hostile and sort of, I guess I was sort of poopy too. and Albert Boothby basically said to me, look, Mr. Cumming, he would say, you know, at age 15 or 14 or whatever it was, you only have two choices. You can either focus on what's been for the last 15 years, or you can recognize there's stuff to get done in the world and get engaged in it. And I started to wake up. He was a very bright person who'd spent lots of his summers teaching at all black schools in the South. And that was an incredible educational process. And he engineered an exchange program between our school and an all-black prep school in 1964. Well, there were only about three of those institutions in existence in 1964, and fortunately the need for them went away relatively shortly thereafter, within 20 years. But they existed because, as you know, in 1964, every school in the United States, for all extents and purposes, or 99% of them, were segregated. And Albert started talking to me about this. And then I became aware of the Civil War. And then I found out really who Abraham Lincoln was. And I found out about all those kinds of things. And I realized that it was not okay for me to be quiet about it, because I couldn't imagine that we lived in this country that was so incredible and that had really, in many ways, been responsible for saving the global world. In World War I and World War II, and yet here we had an entire class of people that were subjugated to second and third class citizenship. And I'll never forget the first trip that Albert took me on to North Carolina. He took us into the county courthouse, and he said, I want you to look around. And he said, now what do you see? And immediately I saw that there were two drinking fountains. And he said, okay, so what does that mean to you? And he said, and I said, well, feels to me like that means there's probably no justice for people of color in this building. And he said, exactly. So what are you going to do about it? And I went, what do you mean, what am I going to do about it? In my mind, I went, what am I going to do about it? But anyway, I went as an exchange student to Palmer Memorial Institute, which was this all black school in a little town called Sedalia. A couple of, again, a side story. That school went out of business in the early 70s, but when I, about 15 years ago, I went on a trip with one of my children down to Georgia to pick up some dogs, and I had a chance to drive right by Sedalia. That school has now been made a state monument. I want you to know, in 1964, the state of North Carolina just as soon burned that sucker down. Anyway, it's now a state monument. Wow. And as I was passing the school, I saw a state trooper pull somebody over ahead of me, and the state trooper got out of his car and he was black. And I went, well, some things have changed. As you know, we've done a lot of things in this country to change the laws and opportunities. We haven't changed hearts yet completely, but we've changed a lot of things. But that was the beginning of it, Molly. And fortunately, Albert said, keep your eyes open and see what you can do to be a contribution. And so that's where it all began. So when you use the word to engage in and see whether I can be a contribution, that resonates with me, because I don't see that there's any purpose for us to do anything else. The idea that the world is all fine, it is. We live in a miracle, Molly. I mean, if I turn my camera around, I have a very modest apartment, but I have a $1 million window. Okay, it's 10 feet wide and 5 feet high, and it looks out over a tidal basin of the North Atlantic. Now, right now, it's overcast. It's November in Maine, but there's water from about 100 yards from here to about a mile that at low tide is clam flats, and at high tide is 10 feet of water. It goes out and comes in twice a day, absolutely consistently, and is predictable 100 years in advance. Now, you tell me that's not a miracle. We have the capacity to end hunger and starvation on this planet permanently in my lifetime, okay? And that's a miracle. We have thanks to the Gates and the Buffetts and various other people, disease as we know it on the planet has been dramatically cut back because there are things we can do. We do live in a miracle. Does that mean I get to sit on my keister and not do anything about it? No. The fact is, I'm one of the pieces of the miracle. Okay, mm-hmm. I've been given some tools. I've been given some things that I can do. I can communicate. And for me, the goal is to have a larger number of people who see themselves as whole and valuable and complete, so that they therefore stop damaging themselves and they also stop damaging other people. I think wellness and human beings' experience that they're loved and valued is the core of all of these things. So since 1961 or two, that's what I've been focusing on. So I'm honored that that's what you think. Am I completely consistent? No, I wish I were. But anybody who tells me they're completely consistent, I think lies a lot. So you know, I've been around a couple of really well-known spiritual people like Thich Nhat Hanh and a few others, and I've seen them reactivated. And that's not a bad thing. I think Thich Nhat Hanh is probably one of the most important and underrated spiritual leaders in the world. But I don't know any of them who don't get reactivated. This is about working on and staying present. So I'll be quiet.
I loved it. Thank you. Thank you so much. Wow. What really struck me, Bill, was when you said, I am a part of the miracle. You're a part of the miracle. That seems to me to be a key connection. Realizing that it's a miracle is not the ending point, it's the beginning point. It's correct. You wake up and it's like, given that you're part of the miracle, why wouldn't you participate, engage, contribute?
Exactly. We have one of the things that I like to point out is that the capacity for all things exists in all people. I know you've listened to the TED talk that I did, and the major point about that was, for me, on the day that Joy was raped, I discovered I have the capacity to kill. And I'm not happy to acknowledge that. And I haven't killed anybody in 37 years, but the fact of the matter is, I know I have the capacity. Without a second's hesitation, I know I have the capacity. Which means I need to be really mindful of the fact that that's inside me. And then shortly thereafter, within 6 months, I met a man who had admitted to me that he was a murderer and a rapist, who demonstrated loving kindness toward me by telling me that he was sorry that my daughter had been raped. And Molly, I knew he meant it. Not maybe, if, or perhaps, I knew he meant it. So here we have a person who's done great violence capable of loving kindness. And I'd spent my life up until 1979 trying to do things that were worthwhile. From that school that I went as an exchange student, we helped found Upward Bound. I'd worked as a YMCA director. I was a teacher. I'd worked in an independent school. And at the time, I was corporate responsibility officer for KeyBank, which is a big national bank. It wasn't at that time, but its predecessors were. And so the fact of the matter is, when I realized that the capacity for everything is inside of us, the question is, it seems to me, is what do we water? What do we nurture? And if we have the capacity to be a contribution, why would we not do that? Now, that doesn't mean everybody needs to be hauling feed bags in Ethiopia, okay? What it does mean is we need to look at how we're living our life. Are we living it consciously? Do we operate in a space of loving kindness all the time? What are the things that I am uniquely qualified or excited about getting involved in? And can I find a way to be used for a purpose that I think is a worthwhile one? My favorite quote about that is George Bernard Shaw's. This is the true joy in life, the being used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one. The being thoroughly worn out before you're thrown on the scrap heap. The being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. I love that quote, obviously, from Man and Superman.
The feverish little clod. I wish that didn't resonate so much.
Well, that was one of the things, God rest her soul. My mom was an incredibly talented person. In 1950, she became the buyer for sportswear for the first store that Lord & Taylor ever built off Fifth Avenue in West Hartford, Connecticut. That was a big deal, Molly. First of all, normally it would have been a man. And number two, she had a high school education. I always felt badly about the fact that she didn't have more training, but she had a high school education. She never thought she did a great thing. Because her story in life was, if only I hadn't married Harold. Well, the problem was Harold was my dad. You know, so it, you know, she kept focusing on that stuff. Well, my mother could go to some of the most wonderful restaurants in the world and find fault with them. All right. But she did turn it around. I don't know whether you know the story.
Yes.
Did I tell you that story? Yeah.
Wait, please share it. I think it's really worthwhile.
Well, my brother and I knew that we were not going to have both of them in the same town. So one of us was going to take one and the other was going to take the other. And my brother and my father did not get along well at that point. And so I took my dad, and Mal took care of my mom. And he took incredible care of her. He and his wife, Mary Abbott, they bought her a condominium on the second floor of this beautiful apartment building overlooking Reed's Lake in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And of course, Mother complained about two things consistently. Number one, it was on the second floor, not the first. And number two, that it had three bedrooms instead of two because it only needed two. Now, if he'd bought her a condominium on the first floor with two bedrooms, she would have complained because it didn't have as good enough a view as the second floor, and it should have had one more room so that there would never have been a problem when I came to visit. It was always, and my sister-in-law should be under the in the dictionary under the word saint. She should, there be a small picture there, because my mother never learned how to drive. So the only thing my mother ever talked about when Mary Abbott was taking her to the grocery store, the pharmacy, the doctors, a hair appointment, anything, all mother ever talked about was the dog hair, the horse hair, your children are too noisy. And my favorite insult of all time from my mother was, and you love your mother more than you love me.
Oh.
Anyway.
In spite of how adorable I am.
exactly right. What's interesting is my mom knew enough about her own negativity to allow me to tell some of these stories even before she woke up. Now, interestingly, in her case, it took the death of my father for it to come about. My dad had four heart attacks and a stroke during the period when he lived with us. He fought back from all of those, including the stroke that the doctors said he'd never recover from. He got back almost all of his abilities and capacities. But he had never imagined himself. He also got prostate cancer. And he ended up, as a function of that, with a bag for his ablutions. And he'd never imagined that. And he was a very prim and proper person. And one day, I would think about 8 months after that happened, he came to me and he said, "Bill, I've changed my mind." And I said, "About what, Dad?" He'd always wanted to live to the year 2000. In his family, all the brothers died before they were 65, because the coming family legend was all the men died before they're 65. But he had always wanted to live to the year 2000. I found it interesting that he lived until 1993. And I suggest that the only reason he died then is because he didn't want to be there with that bag. And he asked his doctor what he needed to do to stop taking medicine so that he would be gone. He literally chose not to be there. And without endangering anybody's medical license or anything else, he just found a way to do that. Anyway, when Dad died, I knew it was my responsibility to call Mother. So I called her on the phone and I said, "Mom, I just want you to know that Dad passed." And she said, "Thank you. I appreciate the call. I'm sure you'll miss him." Mother had a way of a turn of the phrase. She could just reduce you to nothing. But I didn't expect anything else. I just let it pass. About 10 days later, I knew it was time to call her to see how she was doing. And I said, "So, hi, Mom, how are you?" And she said, "Well, I'm not doing very well." And I said, "Why? What's wrong?" And she said, "Well, I think I waited about 10 days too long to say some pretty important things." And I said, "Like what?" And she said, "Well, I think I actually loved your father." And I said, "Well, I think he knew that." And she said, "He couldn't have. I never said it to him." Not once. I said, Mom, you remember 6 or 7 years ago when he was still driving, he wanted to come out and see you, and he came to your door, knocked on the door, and you wouldn't let him in? She said, yep, I remember. I said, well, I'm going to tell you why he was there. He was there because he wanted to tell you how much he loved you, how great a person he thought you were, and he was really sorry it had turned out this way, but he even thought you might have loved him just a little bit. Now, my mother was not an emotional person, and by that time, you could hear her crying on the phone. And I said, Mom, you do not need to worry about Dad. If it's the way he thinks it is, he is up there telling God exactly how it can be improved down here. And if it's ashes to ashes, he's not in any pain anymore. I said, you need to take a look at how things are with your relationships. And I said, I don't mean me. We'd come a long way, Molly. When I first went to North Carolina in that summer following my exchange program in high school, my mother said, if you go, you've just become the end liver in the family and don't bother to come back. We had been down a long, hard road, but we'd made peace. I said, I know that you love me. I don't agree with everything you believe, but you know that I love you and I know that you love me. We're good, Mom. She said, I know who you're talking about. You're talking about your brother and sister-in-law. I said, well, just take a look. If one of them were to pass away, do they know how much you love them and appreciate what they've done? She said, I'll think about it. 3 days later, my sister calls me and says, what did you do to Mother? And I said, I didn't do anything to Mother. And she said, Mary Abbott said, well, she's just spent the last 3 days apologizing for having been a B-I-T-C-H her entire life. And I said, well, that's a step in the right direction. Let's see what happens by Tuesday. And from that time in 1993 until she died in the year 2000, she was a different person, Molly. All the hostility and anger, she started being more gracious. She even accepted being in a nursing home, which it was right for her to be in that particular time. But if she had not awakened in that way, there's no nursing home in the country that could have dealt with her. She was a force in nature. You get the point I'm trying to make.
Well, what I take from it, and there's so many things in that story, and thank you for sharing it. I've heard it a number of times, but for some reason today it moved me especially deeply, so I appreciate that. And one of the things that touched me about it is that whatever stories we have about ourselves, it's never too late. There's no one who is past the point of waking up, of having a better life, a happier life, of making a contribution, that's always available. And
absolutely. No question about it. If you're breathing, you can make a different choice. Mm-hmm. If you want to continue the same pattern that you've been continuing, you can continue to do the same things, which will produce the same result.
Right.
Or you can recognize one of the things I say to people a lot, one of the other things you said when you were talking about me at the outset is that the way we live matters. And for me, it does. I believe more than anything else, in order to get to a place of real wellness, people need to know that they're loved absolutely and unconditionally, and that they're powerful enough to make choices that allow them to take charge of their own life. Well, those things are possible at any point in your life, unless you've reached the place where you don't have the ability to make any choices at all. You can't communicate, if I offered you chocolate and vanilla, you would look at me as if you didn't understand what choice was.
Mm-hmm.
With the exception of those people, everybody has the ability to make those choices. And one of the things I say quite consistently is that there's no such word as easy in relationship to this. It's not about snapping your fingers. It's about recognizing some things and being open to experiencing some things. This view that I referred to before out my window is not a snapshot for me. It's an experience. It reminds me that water evaporates, that it goes into the clouds. It waters the trees that grow the leaves and the grass that allow me to have oxygen, etc. I see miracle when I look at it, and then I realize, oh yeah, and I'm part of it. When I stop every day to recognize not only do we live in a miracle, but I'm a miracle, everything's interconnected, but there's only one thing I can do anything about today, and that's what I choose to do and how I choose to be, I'm set for the day. Because I can't change what other people do, but what I can do is to decide how I'm going to be about it.
Right. And one of the things, and I'm glad this occurred to me, but because I want to make sure to mention your online course, What Every Person Can Do, mm-hmm. which I'm about a little more than three quarters of the way through. And one of the things you share through that course is one way to activate, my words for it, to activate this awareness that everything is a miracle, that you're a miracle, that you have choices, and to set yourself up through a kind of spiritual self-care to take those choices throughout the day. And I just so appreciate that, Bill, because as I was also saying in the introduction, I think there's a misunderstanding in some spiritual communities that there's nothing to be done.
Yeah. Every time I hear that, Molly, I have to say, I go, oh my goodness gracious. That's really not accurate. There's a lot to be done. And it's, is it going to unfold perfectly? Of course it is. But one of the things that is going to contribute to it is the actions that we take today. And one of the things I say all the time, especially to parents, is that you don't know, none of us know, and I say this to teachers too, nobody knows when the most important conversation in the history of the world is going to take place and may already have taken place between what you and one of your children or students or whatever. We don't know who the next Mother Teresa is going to be, or Marie Antoinette, or Martin Luther King, or anybody else. We don't know. So the question becomes, how am I being with those people? And then there's sometimes some doing this to be done. Upward Bound, when we started that pilot, Albert and I wrote a grant to the Ford Foundation and got, I think it was $30,000 a year, maybe. Yes, it was $30,000 a year. We had 60 students, and we did that for 2 years, and then it became one of the pilots for Upward Bound. Well, when the government took it over, they wanted to start doing remedial work with these kids. Well, my experience both as an exchange student and during those first two summers is I knew that those kids didn't need remedial stuff. If they needed remedial things, they'd go create it. They'd go find out what they needed. What they needed was to be around inspired people talking about things that they'd never heard about before. So we put the most inspired faculty we could find, and that's still how Upward Bound is. It's not based on remedial stuff. Kids who end up in Upward Bound are some kids in schools who somebody believes they got a spark someplace, even though their grades don't show it. They may have difficult circumstance, but somebody says the kids got it, and they just go soaring with the program. Well, that's the program that Oprah Winfrey said allowed her to turn her life around. Well, holy mackerel, I'm not taking credit for Oprah Winfrey. The fact of the matter is all I did was do what I did. She did what she did. But, you know, you never know what it is that produces opportunities for other people to take responsibility for things. Buckminster Fuller was a man who I got a chance to meet back in the early 70s. Bucky Fuller is the guy who designed geodesic domes. And the Dymaxion car, the idea of aerodynamic cars was his. His also idea was sustainability in the world. Now, if you think about how popular sustainability is right now, if it hadn't been for John Denver, who was a singer, and Harry Chapin, who was a singer, both of whom are dead, Werner Erhard, who's a self-help guru, and Bucky Fuller, I'm not sure the idea of sustainability would ever have caught on. And when those guys started that thing, everybody thought they were nuts. Because in 1970, everybody believed hunger and starvation was inevitable. Well, that came from a conversation between three people. That's how that got started. My father, my dad, got that organization their nonprofit status because, quite frankly, between Harry Chapin and John Denver and Werner Erhard, they couldn't have balanced a checkbook if their life depended on it. Anyway, you get the idea.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, and you know, as I'm listening to you, it occurs to me, we're all always participating in what's unfolding. So to say there's nothing to be done doesn't make any sense. As long as I'm breathing, I am doing something.
Yes.
I am doing something. So each of us gets to choose how we want to participate beyond that. And it seems to me that if you're moved to join a cloistered convent and pray for the world, that that's an engaged action and it contributes to the unfolding. And if you're moved to teach an upward bound, that's another gesture. There are lots of different gestures, but to pretend that we're not making choices is really disingenuous.
In my experience, that's true, because in every moment, I have a choice about how I'm going to be. Mm-hmm. I can, if I recognize that I have the ability to be in a space of loving kindness, why would I choose not to do that before I engage in a conversation with you? Mm-hmm. Now, one of the disciplines that I apply to myself is when I find myself reactivated, somebody does something and I'm upset or this, that, and the other thing, I do the very best I can to stop whatever I'm doing. So occasionally, I've done this in open seminars from time to time. One time in Great Britain, I found myself very reactivated by a particular participant. And it took me, the first thing I did was stop. I just stopped the seminar and I said, I need about 15 minutes to get myself grounded. I went outside the room, totally alone, got myself grounded, realized that what he was talking about had plugged me into something that had happened 35 years ago, apologized profusely to him, acknowledged that he absolutely had the right to his opinion, and I didn't share it, and that was okay. I was no longer reactivated, and I didn't need to defend my position. Well, those are all choices, okay? Doesn't make them right, but there's what you just said, Molly, is incredibly important. There is no point at which we're not making choices. So if I'm given the alternative between making choices that are likely to be a contribution and choices that are just sort of, as if doing nothing, that's a choice.
Right.
Okay. I could do that. But quite frankly, one of the other things that Albert Boothby got me to see years ago was, if you want to experience real joy and satisfaction, you'll find something you love to do and you believe is worth doing, and you'll never ever go to work. It won't feel like work to you. This doesn't feel like work to me. This mm-hmm. feels like an opportunity to get to know another human being. And by the way, every single person I have ever worked with has affected the way this work is. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, the work that I currently do, and by the way, I examine that work all the time as to whether that's the most important thing I could be doing. I resisted for years developing any kind of online program because I really believed you couldn't communicate what I needed to communicate using electronic means. One of my most humorous conversations, you know, that in the Care of the Soul booklet that we have, and by the way, I'm happy to send that booklet to anybody who's listening. If they want to do that, we can make sure that happens.
Okay.
I put Greg Bear's work in there. The minute I read the book Real Love, and when I read it, I was just staggered because I thought it was brilliant, and I immediately called him on the phone. And I'm one of those people that cold calls people all the time. I didn't know him from a hole in the wall. He's a doctor who ended up with his own drug problem, and then he figured stuff out and woke up. And so I called him on the phone and I said, Greg, I just want to tell you how brilliant the book is. And it's a book I chose not to write because I don't believe that, as brilliant as it is, it's the real issue. The real issue is I can't have you experience that I love you through pages of a book, but I can tell you. And that's what I told him. And he broke out into outright prolonged laughter. And after about a minute of just laughing his tail off, he said, oh my God, somebody I don't have to explain this to.
Oh,
and
nice.
He's done the What One Person Can Do work, and I've been down to one of his retreat weekends and stuff like that. Anyway, but the whole point is you keep evaluating whether what you're doing is the most important thing you can be doing. And some things work and some things don't work. However, there's a great feeling that comes from doing the best you can to be of use. That's how I refer to it. Mm-hmm. And so I have different avenues into which I put my energies, but that never includes just sitting back and watching it unfold. I very much enjoy being an active participant in the miracle.
Yeah, it's beautiful. At the beginning of this conversation, before we started to record, you asked me if we were going to live, and I said something about this would be pre-recorded, and I didn't know when I'd post it. And it occurred to me in that moment that somehow this conversation might be a good thing to post on over the Thanksgiving holiday. And that just really felt right to me, and I didn't have a very clear line of thought or rationale for it. And your response was something along the lines that if we reconstructed what Thanksgiving really meant, that it would be. And that intrigued me. And I wondered if we could go there for a minute.
Sure.
And talk absolutely. About that.
Yep, absolutely. I'm very fond of a public figure right at the moment, and that's this Pope. I really admire him. And the reason I admire him is because he recognizes that what we need to do is clean up our own shop. And he started with the Catholic Church, and he has really ticked off a lot of people because he's putting everything out on the table, and he is going to clean it up. Whether you agree with him or not, he's not going to hide stuff anymore. And that's what he says that we all ought to be doing that and looking for things. Well, one of the huge areas as people who live in the United States we need to look at is a condition that Howard Zinn points out in the real history of the United States. This is not the new world. I studied in seventh and eighth grade the history of the new world. This was not the new world. This world belonged to Native American tribes for hundreds of, if not thousands of years. This was their land. They were wise enough to recognize that there was no such thing as owning land. It belonged to God in Mother Nature, etc. And we just stole it from them, and we messed with them a lot. We took their children and sent them to, you know, schools where they could be reacculturated to think white, and we introduced alcohol into their system. We're still screwing around with them. You know, six, seven, I don't remember how many years ago, the Penobscot tribe in Maine wanted to get a casino, and everybody said, oh, no, we can't let them do it. And so we turned down the Native American tribe, and Barry Dana, who's a friend of mine, was chief of the Penobscots at the time, and he said, I wish this were about something other than racism, but it's not. And lo and behold, three or four years later, somebody else came along and they let them have a casino license. We're still doing this stuff. We keep doing it. Okay. We need to go back and clean this up. Beg forgiveness. By the way, you can't fix it. There's no amount of money that can fix it or anything else, but we need to own it. We need to my parents weren't here. They came from Norway and Scotland or whatever. It doesn't matter. As a country, we need to own it. We need to stop talking as if this was the new world. We need to recognize that how it was done was wrong. And ultimately, that will also lead to looking at some of the other things that have been done, quote unquote, in the name of religion. Aside from greed, the only other purpose for world wars over the years has been religious differences. The reason there's a big deal going on in the Sudan right at the moment is because the Islamic and the Christian missionaries and things like that, they got these people killing each other because they have different religious beliefs. Excuse me? No, let me see that I can get my mind around this. We're going to kill each other because we don't believe the same thing spiritually. If you look at every religion in the world, you come to a place where you realize they're all about learning to love one another better and grow in wisdom. And then we get down to supporting the institution. And the institution needs money and all kinds, and needs to be right, so they need more people and all those other things. And then now we've lost completely what we said we were about. Well, that's a long way to get back to Thanksgiving. What the Pope said was we need to look at what we're doing and how we're being in the world. That's what his message is 90% of the time. I think we need to look at the fact that we are grateful to be alive. And I think Thanksgiving could be a global holiday that was committed to a planet that works for everybody. We have not gotten to the place where we think that yet. We actually talk to other people in ways that are disrespectful and disparaging. Now, I'm not a fan of some of the things that Donald Trump espouses right at the moment. I disagree with him on many things. But the thing he can count on is that I will treat him with dignity and respect and loving kindness. And I will point out that if you don't speak to other people in that way, it actually means that you're fearful and insecure. I am sorry that there are a lot of fearful and insecure people, but we need to stop talking that way to other people. So I think Thanksgiving is an incredible opportunity, Molly. And yes, it needs to be altered from the idea of the pilgrims landing and making peace with the Indians as if somehow there was a problem with the Native Americans to begin with. Anyway, you get the idea.
Yes.
I think you can envision the kind of holiday I was talking about. And my ultimate goal would be for us to really wake up to the notion. You see, I don't believe that the people anywhere in the world want to do individuals harm. There's a little girl that lived here in Maine. Her name was Samantha Smith. Do you ever hear her name?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Well, she wrote a letter to a Russian premier and said, you know, we need to end the Cold War. We need to end the threat of nuclear war. Why don't you send your grandchildren over here and we'll get our president's grandchildren to go over there and that'll end it. Well, now, I think Samantha Smith did as much to wake people up about the stupidity of nuclear war and all this other stuff. We need to look at some things that we refuse to look at. I happen to be a big fan of the people who give their lives to provide what we call security in the world. But the fact of the matter is, every time somebody does something outrageous, we seem to do exactly what we need to do to grow more terrorists. Yes. And the question is, who's really being the terrorist? If you look back 50 to 100 years and you look at some of the things we did, for example, in the Middle East, you're going to find things that we did over there that we should be ashamed of. We need to clean those up. We can't go back and fix it, but we need to go tell the truth about it.
Yeah.
When 9/11 happened, I've never done a broadcast email, Molly. But during the day, I kept waiting for somebody to say, wait a minute, why would people be so angry exactly. that 11 of them would get in planes and kill thousands of people they didn't know and who they knew had nothing to do with it to try to get the world's attention? What were they trying to say? Well, as opposed to having the conversation about why they would do that and what was really going on, what we did was try more bombing and more this and more of that and all that other stuff. Well, the fact of the matter is, that's not going to produce the solution. What might produce the solution, Molly, is all of us deciding that we actually want a world that works for everyone. Which means I don't ever get to be disrespectful to you. I get to treat you with dignity, grace, and loving kindness when I disagree with you. Right now in our country, we can't talk to each other without cutting each other down. We're constantly talking. We're just so disparaging of other human beings. We're never going to solve the problem that way. So yeah, I think it'd be a great thing to do for Thanksgiving. I hope we do it.
I love it. I love it. I know that... One of the things that makes me crazy among my well-meaning liberal friends are jokes about Donald Trump's hair. And it's like, when did that become fair game?
Well, it became fair game. Unfortunately, we're so cosmetically fixated.
Yeah.
I actually thought we were making progress back in the 80s, especially about sexism. But when you find out that the most popular television programs right at the moment are the and most successful financially are the WWF and the World Wrestling Federation. Oh. And if you turn that on and you see how women are treated in that environment, you get pretty clear about why we're still in trouble.
Yeah.
So Trump gets talked about his hair. Women have been marginalized for years because we constantly think that the way a person looks or the way their body is configured has anything to do with who they are.
Right.
I have a little exercise that I do with people. I ask them to just look in the mirror for 1 minute a day for a week.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, it doesn't produce anything. For other people, it produces all kinds of things. But at the end of it, my simple question is, do you think anything you've been looking at for those 7 minutes has anything to do with who you really are? And people usually realize that it doesn't. Who we really are is the desire to love, to be loved, to know that our life has value, and that we're powerful enough to make choices that allow us to take charge of our own lives. But we talk to each other as if what we look like were significant. We've got it all backwards.
Right.
And it's not insurmountable. We can turn this around. It absolutely can be turned around within our lifetimes. We just haven't decided to do it yet.
Yeah.
And anybody who taught, one of the things that's interesting, Marianne Williamson talks about it from time to time. She realized at one point in her career that an angry liberal couldn't bring about peace. If I'm not willing to be about loving kindness towards, and it's interestingly enough, it's something we used to have the ability to do. Diverse political people were able to sit down at a table and talk with one another, actually became friends. I remember growing up, my mother's twin sister's husband had a seat on the New York Stock Exchange. They were in a whole different world than we lived in, completely different world. And when we came to visit, we were the poor Democratic people from Connecticut. We would go and visit. But they would sit and have incredible conversations about restructuring, about the New Deal, about FDR, about Eisenhower, about all of those kinds of things. And they did not agree at all, but they treat each other at least with some dignity and respect. We've lost that ability. We've got to get it back. And we got to mean it, okay? It can't be just tokenism. We've really got to do it. It's what I said before. We've changed a lot of the laws in this country, but we really need to be working on learning to be in a place of loving kindness toward all people. And that's a simple thing to say. It requires, however, some pretty important discipline in order to produce that result.
Right. And I think that's another really important word, discipline, and how we choose to relate to that word. Mm-hmm. A lot of us, and I'm one of them, I've had many different relationships with that word over my lifetime, and I'm intrigued and curious about why sometimes it would seem to me to regard that as a burdensome, limiting things, and other times it's very clear to me that it's an invitation. It involves effort and work. I don't mean to deny that, but there's a way in which discipline is an invitation to engage with life in a particular way. And if I want, I'm thinking of art. There was a time in my life when I made art, and you show up and you do some things. If you want to make something, you have to figure out how to do it, and you practice the discipline to develop the skill. And I never regarded that as onerous. Mm-hmm. Yet sometimes we take that as just a dirty word.
Oh, no question about it. Even regarding self-care, people say, well, why do you want people to, that'll just become a routine. Well, if it becomes just a routine, it's not what I intended.
Right.
I'm intending for people to experience the miracle, but there's another reason, and I can talk about it in two ways. Mostly, there's a story I tell about my granddaughter her throwing mashed potatoes. Have you ever heard that story?
I don't remember.
Okay. Well, the fact is that the eldest of the, what I call my chosen children, Susan, who came to live with us when I was a Y director at the ripe old age of 22.
Wow.
Susan is now just retired as the dean of the College of Education at University of New England. But her daughter, Amy, has just made me a great grandfather. And I got to tell you, even saying that phrase, it's the aging, just the concept anyway, but it's a marvelous thing. One day Susan, the mom, said, can Amy come and spend the night? Cause I want to go do some errands and I'll come back and then we'll go home. Of course, because my teenage children at the time adored having Susan and Amy there. In any case, she said, but we're going to have trouble because Amy's learned to throw food. I said, don't worry about it, Susan. Just go and take care of yourself. It'll be fine. And Susan said, Bill, I'm telling you, it's going to be a problem. I said, Susan, when you lived with us as a teenager, was everything okay? Were you fine? Yes. Great. It's going to be fine. Go do what you need to do. So she left. I told Amy if she threw food, dinner was going to be over. We sat there, talked. I looked at her plate at one moment and I recognized that she was at the place where she was just pushing food, and I knew I should have cleared it, but I was in a conversation with my then senior in high school son and finishing that. And so as I was finishing it, yep, there came the chunk of mashed potatoes right out into the table. So I scooped up the mashed potatoes, Amy's plate, and Amy, and said, but dinner's over. I told you not to throw mashed potatoes. And this is a child who did not cry much as a youngster. And she started to caterwaul like you can't imagine. What? I want my dessert. I'm not done. I said, Amy, I told you if you threw mashed potatoes, dinner was over, or threw anything, food, dinner was over. And she was upset. And I said, now, Amy, you got to make a choice here. You've got to decide if you're this tired, you know, and this upset about my doing what I said I was going to do, then maybe after I'm finished with dinner, you just need to have a quick song and a bath and go to bed. Or if you get engaged in something that you want to do for the next few minutes while I'm finishing dinner, we'll have our normal evening. We'll play games. Neville and Joy will play, and then we can have a wonderful evening, and then you can have your bath and go to bed a normal evening. And I said, but that's your choice. How many steps do you think it took me walking away from her for her to stop crying?
I'm guessing not very many.
I didn't even get the first step down. She stopped crying immediately, and she was fine. We had a lovely evening. She went to bed. Next morning, Susan comes down and says, what did you do to Amy? And I said, "What, Susan, what are you talking about? What do you mean, what did I do to Amy?" She said, well, first of all, you didn't let her have her dessert. I said, no, she threw mashed potatoes, and I told her dinner was over. She threw food. She said, well, I'm not sure I agree with that. I said, okay, that's fine. She said, but the first thing she said out of her mouth this morning was, Mommy, I not throw food anymore. And that began the conversation between Susan and I about the fact that if you want youngsters to know that you love them absolutely and unconditionally, they need to know that you mean what you say in every environment. You can't keep moving the ball. The reason Susan had had trouble with Amy throwing mashed potatoes, she was conflicted about stopping Amy's dinner because she threw mashed potatoes. So Amy knew there was no consequence. That was the end of the discipline as an issue relative to the two of them. They created a magnificent relationship. Amy is spectacular, knows she's loved without condition and always has. It's, you know, you get the idea?
I do. I love that story for so many reasons. So many reasons. I'm going to have to play this back multiple times because there's just lots and lots of good stuff in there. And I guess where I'll go is the last place it took me, which is, gosh, it's hard to make a choice, but that love is the context for the discipline, not the condition of the discipline.
Very good. Absolutely. Yeah. If you talk about discipline as if it's accepted from loving, excluded from loving kindness or separate from, totally inappropriate. If it doesn't take place in the space of loving kindness, I guarantee you at some point or another, it will be inappropriate discipline. Mm-hmm. Okay. The only reason I'm going to set a rule, for all extents and purposes, there's no reason people shouldn't throw food. Mm-hmm. I mean, people want to throw food, throw food. I simply don't choose to have in my house mashed potatoes on the floor. And I want Amy to be able to go into any social circumstance knowing that if she throws food, it's probably not going to work out too well. So I make up the arbitrary rule. My children, for example, used to refer to my parenting style as a benevolent dictatorship. Okay. But benevolent, this is about loving kindness, but there was no confusion about who got the last word. We're not voting on that. I get the last word. When you are old enough to contribute to the rent, pay for the utilities, all the other things, and you want to share in the responsibility for the house, you get to have a say. Otherwise, come on, let's go. We're doing this.
Right.
But there is no separation between discipline and loving kindness. And the other thing is, one of my favorite people is Mahatma Gandhi. And he has a spectacular quote about discipline. Is it any wonder there is so much untruth being delivered to a bewildered world with everyone claiming the right of conscience, i.e. telling you and I how to run our lives, without going through any discipline whatsoever? If I'm not going to be disciplined in my life, how do I get to tell anybody else? One of the things I don't do is tell anybody how to do anything. All I do is love them and propose alternatives. If people want to do what they want to do, that's something I can't control, but I can let them see that there are choices. And I think being disciplined about that makes sense. Right. I think discipline's gotten a bad name, a bad rap over the years. And I also think that we don't have the faintest idea how to train teachers in relation to classrooms. For example, the purpose of school is to assist young people in having meaningful, productive, contributory, joyous lives and have the tools necessary to do so. Good. So I want to know how many classrooms refocus on that and understand what that means before we start the day. because then any interruption to that process means I'm playing takeaway with myself as a student because I've decided I don't want my life to turn out.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, this isn't about me controlling a classroom of 30 students. I'm going to tell you right now, Molly, if a group of 30 first graders decided to take over the room, they'd be in charge.
They'd be in charge. Yep.
Oh, no question about it. And if I'm not grounded as a human being, I'm not going to know how to deal with that.
You know, I'm going to take this back around to your self-care practice, because mm-hmm. the question that arose for me about discipline is that with Amy, you provided the context of loving kindness in which that discipline arose and was enforced. As adults, when we look for a context to impose discipline on ourselves, it occurs to me that when I get confused about discipline, it's because I have not first reconnected with that context of loving kindness, with that miracle of which I'm a part.
Absolutely.
And that if I go back to that and then examine my heart and my conscience and look for what discipline am I called to out of that, then discipline is a no-brainer.
Absolutely.
And whenever I get caught up in an argument about myself with myself about what discipline means, I need to go back to my responsibility to reconnect with that miracle.
And the moment you actually reconnect with the miracle, the what to do is absolutely perfectly clear.
Yeah.
It becomes very obvious.
Nice. Yep. Nice.
Which is why, by the way, the word namaste means so much to me, and the definition of it means so much to me. I honor the place in you where the entire universe resides. I honor the place in you of love, of light, of truth, and of peace. And if you're in that place in me, you, and I'm in that place in me, there is only one of us. All of those things are inside us. The moment I remember that, I know what to do. But when I'm in conflict or something's bothering me or whatever, I've forgotten that. I've forgotten the miracle. And that's what I think we're called to do, is remember that this is a miracle. Mm-hmm. Nothing less than a miracle. The fact that you and I can talk and communicate, let alone the technological miracle. The fact that between us, we have somewhere between 20 and 100 trillion cells. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, anyway.
Kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Beautiful. All right. Bill, how can people find you online?
Well, online, the Boothby Institute is theboothbyinstitute.org. And the online course is whateverypersoncando.org. Either of those are good ways to do it. And they can write me at bill@oneperson.net. If they want to get a copy of Care of the Soul, I'll either give you an electronic copy of it if you want to put it up on your website or whatever. It's the book that I use with all the people who go through the work one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. So. Excellent. And how would you describe your work? I know that's always a difficult one.
Well, no, I'll describe it as best I can. Right now, I'm working with the colonel who is in charge of the Vermont Air National Guard and his entire administrative team. And when we were talking about it, we're there to work on issues of sexual assault, sexual abuse, suicide, PTSD, ultimately. But this conversation, the What One Person Can Do conversation and the online course, are about the experience of being loved absolutely and unconditionally and recognizing that there's always a choice. That's what my work is about. So it's not about me talking, you get brighter. It has nothing to do with gimmicks. The only reason I do the exercises is because that allows people to experience that power inside of them. It no longer is an intellectual conversation. So it's an experientially based process about loving kindness and choice.
All right. And you do that with individuals and organizations of all sorts, from what I can see.
I do it with individuals and
organizations. With anybody who will.
Yes. And the only way we've ever been able to, people ask me, how did I get to do this work with the National Guard? Because one of the people in that National Guard unit was dating the daughter of a very good friend of mine, who I've known since we went to college. He came back from Iraq and Afghanistan with wicked PTSD. And then my friend's, the daughter, dumped him. So he was a mess. But by that time, I'd known him, and we did the work together, and he is pretty grateful for what he discovered was already inside of him and came to be at peace about his life. And so he's talked to every commander he's had since he went through that experience. And finally, this incredible commander of the Vermont Air National Guard right at the moment was not only open to it, but we're already engaged in this process right at the moment. The only way I got into the Maine State Prison is a friend of mine who'd been through the work said, if you want to have an impact on the lives of prisoners, get this guy to talk about it. And anyway, that's how we get to do any of these things. It's all a matter of word of mouth. You can't advertise this. It's like we're going to spend 12 weeks having a conversation about what I know for sure is already inside of you, and you're going to pay me to do it. I say pay me to do it. As you know, I don't ever turn down work on the basis of money. I can't always give it away, but you know, to like certainly not to organizations. But I've never had anybody turn down working with me over the issue of money. So,
yeah, Bill, thank you. I'm so grateful to have come across you. I'm grateful for your time, your example, and I can't thank you enough.
Molly, that's mutual. It is wonderful to get to know you better. Your courage and your ability to communicate about the power that resides inside of you is spectacular. Thank you for the opportunity. Namaste. Many blessings.
Namaste, sir. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. This is Molly Gordon, the host of the Wholeness Hangouts. Thank you for listening. You'll find other Wholeness Hangout recordings at shaboominc.com/wholeness-hangouts. Wholeness Hangouts are typically held on the second Friday of the month, except when they're pre-recorded. And you're welcome to join us using the Zoom video or telephone conferencing platform. Details for how to join the calls are also at shaboominc.com/wholeness-hangouts. Take care and namaste.